The raft sprang from the roof and wrapped around the plane's tail. Barely able to control the plane, the pilot ordered his men to bail out. Somehow he landed, and everyone survived. Finally, there was navigation. Employing a crowd of instruments, navigators groped over thousands of miles of ocean toward tiny islands that were blacked out at night and flat to the horizon. Procedures could be comically primitive. To get sextant readings, one navigator had to stand on a table and dangle out of the roof hatch while a crewman held his legs so he wouldn't be sucked out. Given how difficult navigation was, it's amazing any crews found their destinations. Many didn't. The risks of flying were compounded in combat as planes faced enemy fighters and AA, anti-aircraft fire. Bunching together to fend off fighters and hit narrow target islands, planes collided, fired on each other, and worse. In one incident, as three B-24s flew together through a canyon under fire, two of them bumped. The collision sent Lieutenant Robert Strong's bomber under the plane he bumped, just as that plane dropped a giant mine. The mine crashed into Strong's plane, tearing an 18-square-foot hole in the fuselage, cutting the plane nearly in two. Impossibly, Strong flew the plane 800 miles home as a gaping crack advanced up the fuselage and the tail flapped behind. Later, when a pilot pulled on the plane's tail, it nearly came off in his hand. These combat risks created grim statistics. In World War II, 52,173 airmen were killed in action. A Pacific bomber crewman's tour of duty was just 40 missions. His chances of getting killed before he fulfilled it were 50%. Stricken Pacific bombers usually came down on water. Every airman had a life vest called a Mae West, after the busty movie star. Survivors had to get to rafts immediately because sharks often arrived in vast numbers almost the moment planes hit. Once, coming upon a crash site, Superman's crew saw this firsthand. Hundreds of sharks, some of which looked 20 feet long, were swirling around the life rafts, on the verge of overturning them. The survivors were rescued, but the Superman crew was horrified. In 1943, Louis' USC track teammate Art Redding was knocked unconscious as he ditched his plane, landed it on water. As the plane sank, Redding's navigator, Everett Almond, pulled Redding out and lashed himself to him. As Redding woke, Almond began towing him toward the nearest island, 20 miles away. Sharks began circling. One swept in, bit Almond's leg, and dove, dragging both men under. Then something gave way, and the men surfaced in a pool of blood. Almond's leg had apparently been torn off. He gave his Mae West to Redding, then sank away. For 18 hours, Redding floated, kicking and hacking and attacking sharks, before a search boat found him. For good reason, sharks were feared and loathed by airmen. On one island, it was a popular pastime to lure them to jetties with bait tied to long sticks and lob grenades into their mouths. When the sharks snatched the bait, the men would watch them blow up. For downed men, the odds of rescue were very poor. Many crews went down without sending a distress call, so rescuers had no idea where they'd crashed. Often the military didn't even learn planes were missing until they failed to land at their destinations, sometimes as long as 16 hours after the crash. To make things worse, life rafts could drift dozens of miles a day. Because of this, search areas often extended over thousands of square miles. If searchers did fly near a raft, they likely wouldn't see it. Though search planes generally flew at just 1,000 feet, even from that height, rafts could be mistaken for whitecaps. To avoid stalling, many rescue planes had to be flown so fast that crewmen only had a moment to scan each area before it was gone. The sad truth, known to Louis, Phil, and all other airmen, was that the vast majority of downed men were never found. The improbability of rescue, coupled with the soaring rate of accidental crashes, created a terrible equation. Search planes appear to have been more likely to go down themselves than to find the men they were looking for. It's likely that for every man rescued, several would-be rescuers died. Hunger, thirst, and exposure depleted raft-bound men with frightening rapidity. Some died in days. Others went insane. In 1942, a bomber crashed in the Pacific, stranding 9 men on a raft. Within a few days, one had died, and the rest had gone mad. 2 heard music and baying dogs. 2 scuffled over an imaginary case of beer. Another shouted curses at a sky he believed was full of bombers. Seeing a boat that wasn't there, he leapt overboard and drowned. When the men were rescued on day 7, they were too weak to wave their arms. Of all the horrors facing downed men, the one most feared was capture by the Japanese. The roots of this fear lay in an event that occurred in 1937, early in Japan's invasion of China. The Japanese military surrounded the city of Nanking, stranding civilians and 90,000 Chinese soldiers who surrendered. Japanese officers then issued an order to execute all POWs. What followed was a 6-week frenzy of killing. POWs were beheaded, machine-gunned, bayoneted, and burned alive. The Japanese turned on civilians, staging killing contests, raping tens of thousands of people, mutilating and crucifying them. The Japanese press ran tallies of the killing contests, praising the contestants. Historians estimate that the Japanese murdered between 200,000 and 430,000 Chinese, including the 90,000 POWs, in what became known as the Rape of Nanking. Every airman knew about Nanking, and since then, Japan had reinforced the precedent. In Louis' squadron, there was a rumor that on a Japanese territory in the Marshall Islands called Kwajalein, POWs were murdered. The men called it Execution Island. It is testament to the reputation of the Japanese that in one doomed B-24 falling over Japanese forces, only one man bailed out. The rest were so afraid of capture that they chose to die in the crash. For airmen, the risks couldn't be ignored. The dead were their roommates, their friends, the crew flying off their wing 10 seconds ago. Men didn't die one by one. A quarter of a barracks perished at once. There were rarely funerals, for there were rarely bodies. Airmen didn't speak of death, but privately, many were tormented by fear. Before Louis had left the States, he'd been issued a Bible. He tried reading it to soothe his anxiety, but it made no sense to him. He often left Phil sprawled on his bed, penning love letters to Ceci, as he ran off his worries on the mile course he'd measured around the runway. He also tried to prepare for every contingency, even taking an elderly Hawaiian's seminar on fending off sharks. Open eyes wide, bare teeth, bop shark in nose. Phil carried 2 good luck charms. One was a bracelet Ceci had given him. Believing it protected him, he wouldn't fly without it. The other was a silver dollar. When he finally ran away with Ceci, he said he'd use it to tip the bellboy. "When I do get home," he wrote to her, "I'm going to hide with you where no one will find us." As Oahu's airmen died in droves, a ritual began. When a man was lost, his friends would open his footlocker, take out his liquor, and have a drink in his honor. In a war without funerals, it was the best they could do. Chapter 9 594 Holes. About 2,500 miles southwest of Hawaii sat a lonely little island called Nauru. The world might have left it alone, were it not for what lay under the feet of the grass-skirted natives. Phosphate, a central ingredient in armaments. Japan slammed onto Nauru in 1942, violently enslaving the locals to mine phosphate and build a runway. By spring of 1943, the runway was ready, making Nauru an ideal base from which the Japanese could launch airstrikes. On April 17th, Louis's crew and 22 others were ordered to fly to Funafuti Atoll, the launch point for a strike against Nauru. The pre-mission briefing alarmed Louis. They'd bomb from only 8,000 feet. That week, they'd practiced bombing from that altitude, and the potential of ground fire to butcher them had worried them. Stanley Pillsbury was spooked by another piece of news. There were about a dozen Zero fighter planes defending Nauru. Zeros had a deservedly fearsome reputation. The prospect of 12 of them scared Pillsbury to death. The next morning, the men walked to Superman. At 5 a.m., they were airborne. The planes took 6.5 hours to reach Nauru. No one spoke. Superman led the mass of bombers, flying with a plane on each wing. The sun rose and the planes flew into a clear morning. The Japanese would see them coming. Navigator Mitchell broke the silence. They'd be over the island in 15 minutes. In the greenhouse, Louis shivered. Superman was the first plane to cross over Nauru. The air was eerily still. Louis's first target, a collection of planes and buildings, appeared below. Louis began lining up on the gleaming planes. Then, shattering. The sky became a fury of color, sound, and motion as the Japanese gunned skyward. Metal flew everywhere, streaking up from below and raining down from above. Something struck the bomber to Superman's left. The plane sank as if drowning. Then the plane to the right fell away. Pillsbury could see the men inside, and his mind briefly registered that they were probably about to die. Superman was alone. Louis kept his focus below, trying to aim for the parked planes. There was a tremendous bang and a terrific shudder. A dinner table-sized chunk of Superman's right rudder blew off. Louis lost the target. While he tried to find it, the plane rocked as a shell bit a wide hole in the bomb bay. At last, Louis had his aim, and the first bombs spun into their targets. Then Louis lined up on a barracks and a gun battery and watched the bombs crunch in. He had one bomb left to use as he chose. He spotted a shack. The bomb fell, and Louis yelled, "Bombs away!" and turned the valve to close the bomb doors. There was a pulse of dazzling light. Louis had made a lucky guess and a perfect drop. The shack was a fuel depot, and he'd struck it dead center. A giant orb of fire billowed upward. Phil and Cuppernell pushed Superman full throttle for home. Zeros were suddenly all around, spewing bullets and cannon shells that exploded on contact. They flew at the bombers head-on. Cannons firing, slicing between planes so close Louis could see the pilots' faces. The Zeros were ravaging Superman. In every part of the plane, the sea and sky were visible through gashes in the bomber's skin. Every moment, the holes multiplied. The plane was gravely wounded, trying to fly up and over onto its back. The pilots needed all their strength to hold it level. In the greenhouse, Louis saw Zero dive at Superman's nose. Nose gunner Mitchell and the Zero pilot fired simultaneously. Louis felt bullets slashing around him, one just missing his face. Then, as the plane sped toward a head-on collision, the Zero pilot jerked. Mitchell had hit him. For a moment, the Zero continued directly at Superman. Then the stricken pilot collapsed onto the yoke, forcing the Zero down under the bomber before crashing into the ocean. Superman trembled on. There were still two Zeros circling it. In the top turret, facing backward, Pillsbury had twin machine guns that could take down a Zero, but the Zeros were below, where he couldn't hit them. Feeling a Zero's rounds thumping into Superman's belly, he thought, "If he'd just come up, I could knock him down." He waited. The plane groaned and shook, the gunners fired, and still he waited. Then he heard an ear-splitting kabang, 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 and felt a sensation of everything tipping and blowing apart, an excruciating pain. A Zero had sprayed the entire right side of Superman with cannon shells. The first rounds hit the tail, spinning the plane onto its side. Shrapnel tore into the leg of tail gunner Lambert, who hung on as Superman rolled. The plane's twist saved him. A cannon round struck the spot where his head had been an instant earlier, exploding so close his goggles shattered. Ahead, shrapnel dropped Brooks and Douglas at the waist guns and Glassman in the belly turret. Finally, a shell blew out the wall of the top turret, shooting metal into Pillsbury's leg. Superman reeled crazily on its side and for a moment spiraled out of control. Phil and Kuppernell wrenched it level. Clinging to his gun as shrapnel struck his leg and the plane spun, Pillsbury shouted the only word that came to mind. "Ow!" Louis heard a scream. When he ran from the nose, the first thing he saw was Harry Brooks, lying on the Bombay catwalk, his torso bloody. The Bombay doors were wide open and Brooks was dangling partway off the catwalk, one hand gripping the catwalk and one leg swinging in the air. He reached toward Louis, a plaintive expression on his face. Louis grabbed Brooks and pulled him off the catwalk. He could see holes dotting Brooks' jacket. There was blood in his hair. Louis dragged Brooks into a corner. Brooks passed out. Louis returned to the Bombay. He remembered turning the valve to close the doors and couldn't understand why they were open. Then he saw it. A slash in the wall, purple liquid splattered everywhere. The hydraulic fluid lines which controlled the doors had been severed. With the lines broken, Phil would have no hydraulic control of the landing gear or flaps, which he'd need to slow the plane on landing, and without hydraulics, they had no brakes. Louis cranked the Bombay doors shut, then looked to the rear. Douglas and Lambert, both bloody, were pawing along the floor trying to reach their guns. Louis shouted to the cockpit for help. Phil yelled back that he was losing control of the plane and needed Kuppernell. Louis said it was an emergency. Phil braced himself at the controls, and Kuppernell got up, saw the men in back, and ran to them. Louis knelt beside Brooks. Feeling through the gunner's hair, he found two holes in his skull. There were four large wounds in his back. Louis strapped an oxygen mask to Brooks's face and bandaged his head. He thought about the plane. The gunners were wounded, the plane was shot to hell, and there were still two Zeros near. "One more pass," he thought, "will put us down." Louis felt something drip on his shoulder. He glanced up and saw Pillsbury in the top turret, blood streaming from his leg. Looking absolutely livid, he was gripping the gun and sweeping his eyes around the sky. His leg dangled below him, his pants shredded and boot blasted. Next to him was a large, jagged hole in the side of the plane. Louis tried to doctor Pillsbury's wounds. Pillsbury ignored him. He knew the Zero that had hit them would return to finish the kill, and he had to find it. Suddenly there was a whoosh of upward motion, a gray, shining plane, a red circle. Pillsbury shouted something unintelligible, and Louis let go of his foot just as Pillsbury whirled his turret around to face the Zero. The Zero sped directly toward Superman. Pillsbury was terrified. With a flick of the Zero pilot's finger on his cannon trigger, Superman would carry 10 men into the Pacific. Pillsbury could see the pilot, who would end his life. The sun illuminating his face, a white scarf coiled about his neck. Pillsbury thought